Welcome to the She Negotiates podcast, where we help you claim your value, earn your worth, and smash glass ceilings. Each episode will feature an in-depth interview with an expert on how to negotiate with your doctor, your employer, your children's school, and of course, your family. Tune in to hear great stories and get actionable advice with your host, Victoria Pinchon.
Cassandra Lawrence, welcome to the She Negotiates podcast.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's terrific to see you. You've been in Washington, D.C. for a long time, and of course, we've all been locked down, so still a Zoom connection or a Zencast connection is a good one to have.
Yeah, it is.
So we've talked a little bit about this, and we've talked a little bit about your experience in conflict resolution, particularly countries that are engaged in armed conflict. And I think that you did some work in Belfast on that, and then more recently, Islamophobia and conflict among different religious groups, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of negotiation in that.
Yeah.
But before we talk about negotiation and what you're doing now and how you think the techniques you've learned to negotiate armed conflict and negotiate religious disputes, let's hear a little bit about you. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about your career path? I know that you've spent most of your career in the nonprofit world. Why don't you start with what motivated you to seek a life of service and then just move into how you pursued that?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on this broadcast, and I'm excited to see what all the episodes turn out to be. What motivated me in this, I was just in a public narrative training about a month or so ago with some other activists, mostly Muslim activists or people that are identified or perceived to be Muslim. And at that training, some Tide Allies folks are invited to participate. And so I was one of those non-Muslim folks in the room. And this training really helped me understand what my personal narrative is and why I do this work. And so for me, why I do this work is actually comes from a story. I was probably 12 years old on my first high school youth trip. In my church, high schoolers would go away for a week to a mission camp where we would help do small home repairs on Native American reservations. We would learn about God. We would meet other folks. We would learn about our history of indigenous, of oppression for indigenous folks. And I was super excited to go. And when I went, about midweek, I decided that I wanted to sit in the van with the cool high schoolers. With the older high schoolers, I was coming in as a freshman. I was definitely not cool. I had pants that were too short and hair that was pretty frizzy at that point. And those kids did not want me in their van. And they said something mean that I don't remember anymore. And I was crushed. And I walked away and I went along the shore of the lake where we were at and just sang and prayed to God and sang my favorite song from Little Orphan Annie, "The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow," and sat and just cried a little bit. But soon enough, a woman who was also on her first trip as a chaperone, Helen, she came and she found me and she sat next to me and heard my story about why I was crying. And then we both walked back to the group and she helped me find some other girls to swim with while she went and dealt with the older kids. And what that experience taught me was that we have these great ideals about our society. And for me, coming from a faith community, from the Methodist Church, we have these great values and ideals of what we want to do and how we want to be for justice and love and equity and liberation. And then we fail. and we hurt each other. And that is heartbreaking. But then we also have people like Helen who show up to bridge the gap, to mend the wound, to help right the wrong. And so I realized in that moment, though not consciously until later, that I wanted to be one of those people. Like, I wanted to be one of those folks that helped meet the wound, to be there with people when they're crying on the beach or when we're doing the work that I'm now humbled to do, which is addressing anti-Muslim discrimination and violence. And so that is what really motivates me. I didn't really put it all together until this summer, that story and that experience really exemplifies what I think we're called to do, what I'm called to do.
It's a virtuous circle.
Yes.
It's what I've learned in the women's movement, frankly, is that when women support and mentor and sponsor one another and pull each other up to the next level and as you say, address whatever wounds they're experiencing, that's the beginning of a virtuous circle. And I've experienced it with She Negotiates because women get so excited about learning how to negotiate compensation and promotions. And, you know, women are very troubled right now. They've been saddled with enormous burdens trying to school their kids at home and continue working. A lot of women have had to drop out of the workforce at the peak of their careers. And yet I've found ever since the summer of 2020 that there's a renewed desire to be present for other people, and particularly within women's groups for other women. And it's it feels like a revival or a resurgence. The wound of the summer of 2020, which was severe, has, you know, resulted in Simone Biles at the Olympic, I think.
Yeah.
It's resulted in renewed, a renewal of a genuine commitment to diversity and allyship. And unfortunately, sometimes we have to hit bottom as a society.
Before
we have the opportunity, and you hit bottom there by the lake at 12, which is when we all hit bottom, right? At 12. Hit bottom at 12, and yet that it was the beginning essentially of your career in public service.
That's
inspirational. So tell our audience how you managed to fulfill that mission that began by that lake when you were 12 years old.
Well, first, I'm interested in, like, because I know that you were involved in the women's movement earlier, like, do you think that this is a different experience of that time? Like, do you think that same solidarity, that it's shifted, or that, yeah.
I do, because there was a falling away with Gen X, and you are kind of at the cusp between millennial and Gen X, right?
Yes. Yeah.
There was a big falling away with Gen X, which I've read historically. I've read historically that the next generation often retaliates against the mother. And if your generation were the suffragists, then the next generation is going to be the stay-at-home moms. And we're still wrestling with women's ability to do to pursue the life and the mission that they want to have. And yet, you know, it's thesis antithesis, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that Gen Y renewed the women's movement.
Yeah.
And I don't know, was it the fourth wave? I don't know what wave it is. We were second. We were called the second wave women's movement.
Yeah. But I think this is third wave, I think is the.
You know, a lot of bad happens in activist circles. But before we go to the bad that can happen in activist circles, tell us a little bit about your educational background and your work history that put you in a position today where I understand you're now working with an organization called Shoulder to Shoulder.
Yeah.
Which is also an anti Islamophobia organization. Yes.
Yeah. So what put me there was a trip in 2000 again with my church to Israel and Palestine, and it was just before the Second Intifada started, and travel restrictions were only started coming out while we were on that trip. And I met Christian peacemakers there in Hebron in the West Bank. And I started to learn where my U.S. tax dollars were going and how it was being used to fund wars abroad. And this was through foreign aid. But growing up in my middle class, white America, sort of liberal sense of that, oh, everybody should just get along, right? Like, isn't that what we mm-hmm. all do? Like, we all just, mm-hmm. why can't we just get along? I don't understand. I was 18. So, you know, it's pretty normal. Like, okay. And I didn't know it then, but it started this puzzle of like, why? Why is this happening? Again, like when I was at that lakeside, like, why is this, why are people hurting each other? And why can't we like figure out how to not? And so I started studying religion. I started studying history of conflict and war. I went to Northern Ireland and did my master's in comparative ethnic conflict there and studied mediation with Mediation Northern Ireland, a local mediators group. And all those things still didn't answer it for me. And so eventually, like I was in AmeriCorps for a year doing hurricane recovery and some other things. And during the Arab Spring, when that started, I was working in a youth group as a youth group leader in Northern California, which was a great, fun job. But I was looking at all the reports and I was like, where are the peacemakers? Where are the religious folks that are there on the line? Because I had studied and written about Islamic nonviolence in Israel and Palestine and in the Quit India campaign. And I was like, I know that they're there. I know that they're there. Where are they? And that just sort of started this turning inside of me that had me then sell everything, sell the condo that I had just renovated, quit my job, give my mom a heart attack, not really, but you know, metaphorically. And come and stay on a friend's couch in DC and try and get into this world of peace building and religious, faith-based peace building. And so, yeah.
So you learned that there was a lot of activity in Washington, DC.
Yeah.
That you might have an opportunity to join in a, like, an international peacemaking. Was it,
yes.
Were you focused on religion at the time you went?
Yeah, I was focused on, so my first internship was with the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, and they work a lot with trying to support faith-based peace builders and traditional peace builders around the world. But then eventually I ended up with the Network for Religious and Traditional Peacemakers helping to bridge the gap between what we call human rights-based peace builders who work for the UN, the EU, the State Department, and religious and traditional peacemakers, because time and again, they were discovering that their peace agreements, that their negotiations were falling apart, and they weren't really getting the community buy-in that they needed to make peace stick, to make these like issues, to make the policy changes stick. And they knew that they were failing. And so they asked folks like the Center for Religion and Diplomacy and others who do similar work, what they were doing wrong, like what's going on. And so that's how I ended up on a research project where I was able to interview peace builders from around the world, human rights-based ones, traditional and religious-based ones, to ask, like, what are the things that work? What annoys you about the other side, the human rights-based peace builder or the religious-based peace builders? And learned a lot from that, and really rediscovered that there's some structural issues about how UN and State Department and these groups move their staff around too often to really build trust in a community. And so how can they really, how can they use what they can to help support religious and traditional peace builders that are working?
And did you find that the secular peace makers were missing a religious element in the conflict?
Yeah, it's really sad to hear the stories of like diplomats flying into like Israel and Palestine getting a 3-page briefer on the religious dynamics. And you're like, I'm sorry, 3 pages? Is that like size 6 font? With zero margins, like literally that's how much information they were getting. And so that also there's a sense that there was a blindness to the secular worldview that happens within diplomatic circles and within liberal, like quote unquote liberalism, of that there is like a worldview. There's a way that you have structured and determined who people are and the way the world functions. And that's considered like a worldview, whether it's a religious worldview and includes a higher power or not. And that diplomatic corps and folks that are working at the UN and the EU are not all secular, but they're working within this structure and format that sort of sees religion as this passé thing. That's changing because of the work of folks that I've been working with, like who have been doing it for decades. But it's still a rough road to get legitimacy for people that are doing really good and critical work on, like, in their communities.
So I have a husband who you know,
yes,
who blames religion for the conflicts and believes that religion primarily stokes conflict. You're in a field in which you're saying religion helps resolve conflict. Can you tell our listeners how the secular and the religious have worked together, like specifically what they've done in order for the religious peacemakers to resolve conflict instead of to stoke it?
Yeah, so I think that it's really unhelpful to say like religions are all about war or religions are all peaceful. So like, you know, when we're addressing Islamophobia or anti-Muslim sentiment, we don't say like religions are X. Like, we're just peaceful. It's like, no, look at human history. Neither of those is 100% true, which means that it's all true, right? And so that we're human and we're going to fail and we're going to try again and do better again next time. And so this whole idea of, the better angels, how do we call forth those better angels? And that religious and traditional actors are embedded in the community in a way that helps us remind people of the narrative of the community, of what those deep values and ideals of solidarity, of liberation, of taking care of the poor, of welcoming the migrant, welcoming the stranger. And so that there is a sense that folks that are leaders within that space, that are religious and spiritual leaders, can help call those better angels back into play. And you see it like there's a really great case study from Rwanda of just before the Rwandan genocide happened was Ramadan. And everybody knew the country was a powder keg. it was an open, everybody knew anything was going to set off something any minute. And the mosques, the Muslim community in Rwanda is compromised, is comprised of both Hutus and Tutsis. So they had people of many different tribes and ethnic identities in their communities. And during Ramadan, many of the sermons that were given were talking about how we are Muslim first. We care for each other. We protect each other. We protect the widow and the orphan. And we will do that for anyone, not even just Muslims, but that is what we're called to do as a community. Once the genocide started, those communities actually formed solidarity and were hiding each other and protecting each other so that when mobs would come in and say, tell me if you're Hutu or tell me if you're Tutsi, they would say, no, we're all Muslim.
So... So I frankly never hear these positive stories.
I know.
And I'm completely, until this moment, I have been completely unaware of them.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is, as horrific as the genocide in Rwanda was,
yeah,
that there were religious actors who were working to save the people. It was the Tutsis, correct, who were massacred?
Yes, I can't. I'm sorry.
Yes, I think it was the Tutsis who were massacred.
Yeah,
could be opposite. I forget as well. But what you're saying is that there was a core of the religious who acted against the genocide.
Yes.
And saved some people,
yeah,
from the horrors of those events.
Yeah, they created islands of protection for each other and for others. And it wasn't just the Muslim community. You saw those like at different places in the country, but the Muslim community stands out because of just timing, that Ramadan happened just before that. And Ramadan is about community and solidarity and generosity and charity. And so like, so that particularity of how that timeline happened meant that they were able to protect each other as best they could.
Okay, we could talk about many things right now, but
yes.
what I'm interested in talking to you about, you having just graduated with a master's degree in divinity.
Yes.
Correct?
Yep.
From Wesleyan?
Wesley.
Wesley Seminary in Washington, D.C., right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So I understand that there's a fairly new term arising in Christianity, and that is the religious left,
mm-hmm,
as well as the religious right. And to be devil's advocate, I would say, well, you're talking about liberal, social justice warrior, woke Christians. What about those who are on the right? Is, mm-hmm, have there been efforts to make the same kind of to achieve the same kind of peaceful resolution between these two groups that appear to be working for opposite goals?
The short answer, yes. the longer answer is that I was just moments before I came on for this, I was in a workshop talking about the terrorist framework and this whole idea of left and right, and that in that polarity and in creating that polarity, we're somehow saying that they're both, that they're equal to each other in some way, when in fact what we're talking about, especially when we're talking about white supremacists and white nationalists, is that they are sort of outside of what many people would consider like acceptability. Like there's no equal to that on the left. But that there are, but one of the things that a lot of groups are asking themselves, especially interfaith circles and community building circles is how to continually open up space for people that are politically different than they are. Because
how is that going, and what are you doing in order to achieve that?
Yeah, and so it's going in that the simple things of supper dialogues, guided facilitated dialogues. There's numerous different groups, Faith Matters Network, Resetting the Table, People's Supper, all around meals, if you'll take that reference. And what's really interesting is that our work at Shoulder to Shoulder has included like trying to reach out to evangelicals, white evangelicals, to participate in this work, in the work of addressing anti-Muslim discrimination and violence. And something that I've discovered, which was good that I was doing it while I was in seminary, was that theologically, myself as a United Methodist, who's pretty progressive liberal, may not agree with a lot of folks that are even United Methodists that politically are very different. However, what we found in the work for Shoulder to Shoulder is that many people would say, but there is a problem with how we're treating refugees. There is a problem with how we're treating immigrants. There is a problem with how we're treating our neighbors, regardless of whether, like, our politics. And that we could find common ground to work together to do that. In that working together, what I think I've discovered in it is that liberal worldview, that framework that I still have, along with my religious framework, that was inadvertently communicating to people that are more conservative, that there was actually a series of ideas that they needed to buy into in order to participate. That they needed to buy into the entire liberal framework in order to participate. And so there's been a back and forth and a dialogue about, like, how do we have conversation when we're not going to buy into each other's frameworks for the whole thing.
Interesting. I had
20% or 50% or whatever. There's like specific issues we can work together on, that we can agree on the issue.
I had an experience in the 2016 election. I was poll watching on behalf of the Clinton campaign. And poll watchers are not allowed to roam freely about. There's actually a square on the floor, and you sit there, and you can ask permission to, you know, get something to eat and come back. But that's your role, and to make yourself available if somebody has a problem. Mm. So, and directly next to me was a poll watcher appointed by the Trump campaign. And so I thought, okay, you know, we'd been through a pretty brutal election season. And, you know, what was it going to be like spending the day with this woman who was active in the Trump campaign? And what I found was that we didn't talk about politically divisive issues. I mean, we both clearly were avoiding politically divisive issues. So we talked about children, we talked about school, we talked about family. I think we talked a little bit about religion. We talked about the weather. I mean, you know, and sometimes, you know, views that she had, for instance, about education might differ from mine, but they weren't heated. Yeah. And at the very end of the day, it was a surprise to both of us that Trump prevailed. And I was pretty despondent. And she reached over to me and put her hand on my arm and said, "I'm so sorry. I know you must feel terrible." Mm-hmm. And I said, frankly, right now, the only reason I feel any goodness inside of me is that I know that you're happy. And we weren't bullshitting one another. You know, it was, so we did experience what you're talking about experiencing, which is you can bring people from warring factions together and have them form relationships, no matter how short a time they've been together, that will at least stop them from seeing people who hold different political views as being evil.
Yeah.
To stop that polarity of good and evil. But at the end of the day, do you have any research showing that it like improves relations in general, that it helps stop hate crimes? Because I'd love to know more, actually, and I think our listeners would like to know more about, is there really something we can do about these political divides that's healthy and that makes a genuine difference?
Yeah. I can share some of that, and I will in a second. And I think first I want to say that there's a woman, Deepa Iyer, who talks about the social change ecosystem. And it's really important to recognize what your role is and what your context is in order to determine what your role is in the social change ecosystem. So that some of us are bridge builders, some of us are able, for many different contextual reasons, to walk to the other side of the river, or to walk to the other side and have those conversations and move people, both ourselves and others. And others of us need to man the first aid tent for people that have been wounded. Like, people need to, like, so that there's different roles and places for us in this time, because I hear a lot of different activists saying, I'm tired of building bridges, like, I'm just done. And that's a real place to be. And you should take a break if that's the case. And that's, you know. And
Serve coffee.
Yeah, serve coffee. Just you know, like with many of the demonstrations that were happening in D.C. last summer, every day there was something happening at Black Lives Matter Plaza, at the White House, in front of Congress, everywhere. And so some days it was just like, let me just man the snack booth. I'm gonna hand out water and snacks and make sure everyone's hydrated and has sunscreen on. And other days I was like guiding people, like helping them understand what was happening and kneeling and doing more stuff that was like on the, quote unquote, on the field or whatever. But it's all participating in this moment. So with that said, there is lots of data talking about how we actually change hearts and minds and how we rehumanize each other. And that, you know, it is possible for us to have different political views and still see each other as human. And to see that, oh, you feel pain just like I do. You feel love just like I do. Like the Quakers during the Paris Climate Agreement negotiations had these meals where they would sit and have people come to these meetings. People from all different negotiating parties would come and have dinner with them. And they would have these questions like, tell us a story about when you were a kid playing. Tell us, like, it was story time, and they're sharing stories with each other. And there was folks that also did this in South Africa as it was transitioning from apartheid to post-apartheid, like where they brought people together just to listen to each other and hear stories with each other. And so that when you're at the negotiating table and your partner walks off, like the person that you're trying to negotiate with walks off and you all take a break, you can go find them in the hallway and say, hey, how's it going? Maybe, like, maybe you're able to, maybe not you, maybe your friend or maybe someone else, like, is able to say, like, what's going on? Like, you walked away. We're here to resolve this. And so that's sort of the pre-work that happens in negotiations, right? Is like helping us better understand each other's humanity.
So would you say, now that we're talking about negotiation, would you say that listening to your negotiation partner is just as important as selling them on your idea?
Yes.
And why is that?
because people know when you're not listening to them. It builds trust. It helps people. So when I'm teaching about negotiation and diagnostic questions, that they're doing to the diagnostic questions are serving multiple functions. One of them, it's getting you information and alternatives and like helping right. you expand the options.
So yeah. define diagnostic questions so the listeners will understand.
Thank you. Yes. So diagnostic questions are simply like asking your negotiating partner more information about the issue. So like, how's business? You sent out an email recently about like ask your boss, how's business? What, like if you're thinking about supply chains, how are the supply chains going for you? What are some issues that we're having? How can I help you? Like, and so it's putting yourself in the position of a, like, as Christian, I would say a servant leader to be like, how can I help you? And it's asking them and it's probing deeply. And if you're doing it with truth and compassion, that's going to be felt by the other person to say, oh, this person's actually interested in what I'm going to say. And so it's doing a couple of things. It's getting you information so that you can build a better sense of where your points are for agreement and where disagreement is and where you can push and where you can pull back. But it's also building empathy, because then that empathy helps your partner see that maybe you understand them because you've listened to them. People don't build empathy by me talking at them. People trust me because I've listened to them, because I've asked them deep like questions like, how are your kids today? How's like, what did, like, you know, just these questions that help show that you're interested in who they are.
And also so that you can offer assistance as well as asking for whatever it is you want to ask for them.
Yeah.
From them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not leaving your issues aside. It's not saying I'm only here to help you. Like
Right. So you're relationship building.
Yeah.
Hoping that both it will create some fellow feeling that you think might sort of trump the suspicion that negotiation partners have of one another's motives. I had a lawyer tell me, I was talking about diagnostic questions and trust building, and he said, I wouldn't answer any of those questions. And I said, why not? And he said, because the way you've described it, you're just gathering information for the purpose of manipulating me into doing what you want to do, which shows an extremely high level of distrust. And I can tell you that after 25 years in the legal system, it took me years to stop distrusting people immediately and so deeply.
Yeah.
But what would you say to those people that, well, you're just gathering information for the purpose of trying to put one over on me?
Like, well, I mean,
you'd say, I hear you.
I hear you. Yes, I am. I am trying to understand you. I'm trying to understand what makes you tick, why you care about this issue so much that you're at this table, why you care so much about this issue that we like prolonged it so long that now we have a mediator here. Like, what is like, it helps me better understand like where, how we can resolve this issue.
So,
you can ask me questions too. They can be like, you know, say like, what do you want to know?
And I like that energy, because some people consider mediation to be like a lot of roasting marshmallows over an open fire and singing Kumbaya. And yet what I hear in your voice is a little bit of get over it. You know, you need to come back into conversation with me if we're ever going to resolve this problem. And you're not being meek and mild.
No.
So it's not all about just kindness.
No.
No. It's about really getting to the problem, to the bottom of the problem, with the hope that if you do so, that's going to enable you to have a more creative negotiated response.
Yeah, well, and because one of the things that I've learned in doing in the international peace building is a book called Recentering Conflict Transformation. And one of the things that it looks at is how mediation can sometimes reinforce the power dynamics that actually caused the conflict in the first place.
And give an example of that for our listeners.
So let me think. Two people coming into, I'm trying to think of a really good one, and my mind is blank at this moment.
How about school boards and critical race theory?
Yes. Yes, that is a good thing. And I think that it ends up
how would you get to the bottom of that as a mediator or as a negotiator? So that we don't have people screaming and yelling at one another and calling each other names in school board meetings.
Yeah. So I would say I would go back to what we do at Shoulder to Shoulder and how we help folks respond to anti-Muslim discrimination and violence, because a lot of that stuff, actually the same channels that are filtering the anti-critical race theory stuff, that are filtering the vaccine resistance, not even the hesitancy, but the resistance, the same channels that are filtering anti-Muslim discrimination and violence are all the same. It's the same channels. Like, the Islamophobia industry is an industry with millions of dollars pumped in to figure out what are the keywords to keep us afraid of each other and divided from each other and wedded to a security framework that keeps our prisons overflowing and keeps us afraid. And so that...
Why do those people want to do that?
Money and power. And also there's the white supremacy framework of, you know, that we are going, the white race is disappearing. And that the world was better at another time. It's also, I remember Eboo Patel talking about this, about this sense that especially conservative white communities have been fed this narrative that you get a job. Everybody gets a job. Everybody, you can work, like, you don't have to have a college degree in order to make a living and have a house and, like, be good and be a, like, righteous family. And that's just not true anymore. Like, our country, our economics have changed. Four-year education is, like, baseline for most, like, white-collar jobs. And so the economics have changed, and there's a lot of despair and anger in that community. And also you see, like, actually the death rates are really high for the opioid epidemic. Some people... and so there's a lot of different things happening in there. But the people pulling the money and creating the channels, they're just profiting off of it because they see an opportunity, right? So
they see an opportunity to accrete power to,
yes,
the people who would solve problems the way they think they should be solved.
Correct. Yeah.
So if you sat down someone who's violently opposed to the teaching of, say, the history of the genocide of the genocide of Native Americans.
Yeah.
Someone who is violently opposed to teaching that to school children because they deeply believe that that's going to make the school children think there's something wrong with them and they don't want their kids to feel that way.
Yeah.
As opposed to the people who think we should acknowledge essentially our country's sins and make amends mm-hmm. and actually move past these problems. How do you put those two people together in a way that's productive instead of destructive?
You don't. No, because this is what happens in these conversations is we imagine the like most vocal, most extreme person. Like, I'm going to sit down with Steve Bannon and change his mind. No, I'm not. Cassandra Lawrence in Washington, D.C., who is a vegetarian, yoga, playing guitar, is not going to be able to change Steve Bannon's mind. Like, that's just not going to happen. No, I'm not the person.
So who do you work with?
And how do
the people who you work with make a change in the larger society?
So how the way that we understand how change happens is through social influence. And so you look at the people that are immediately around you. And so the folks that we work with in Shoulder to Shoulder campaign are people that are not Muslim, that are at their coffee hour after church or after synagogue or after temple. And they hear someone say something that's an anti-Muslim trope, it's a myth, whatever. And those are people that they already have the relationship with. And they can go up and say, hey, actually, I don't have that experience with Muslims. Like, actually, did you know that our kid's second grade teacher is Muslim? And every year she like invites our kids over for like Eid at the end of Ramadan. And they're like jumping on the trampoline and they're in the pool and you know, what, like, so it's not to be disingenuous or to shut down conversation, but it's to acknowledge that these conversations, that how you actually change someone's hearts and mind is through consistent, small conversations like that. And so it's like when people talk about parents, now parenting textbooks talk about how you have the quote unquote, the sex talk with your kids. It's not through one conversation. It's through repeated conversations about consent, about your body, about like whatever, all these pieces, just little things over the years actually helps form our values and helps change your worldview. And so first you understand your context and who you have that relationships with, and then you build on those shared ideals. So you say like, you know, I hear you're really concerned about bullying at school. Like, you're worried. Well, I'm worried too. You know, did you know that like Muslim kids, like that's the top concern for Muslim families in the U.S. is bullying in schools? And did you know that most of the time that's actually from adults, that they're getting bullied from adults? And isn't that terrible? Like, do you think we can do better to all of our kids? And so it helps draw the circle around the person that is saying the anti-Muslim trope, as well as, in this case, Muslims, and say, look, we're all in the same circle here. We all have that same ideal of a country that where you can be free to pray or not pray, where you can go to school and not be worried about being bullied. That's what we all want, right?
So, yeah. And now that takes me back to the diagnostic questions.
Yes.
Because maybe I'm misassuming that this person like really cares about bullying.
Exactly.
But so I would open by not selling them on an anti-bullying regime.
Yeah.
But right?
Yeah.
But finding out first. So that must be part of the everyday conversations that you're talking about, that you actually grow to know someone.
Yes.
And understand what's important to them.
Yeah.
And when what's important to them is part of the higher angel of their nature.
Yeah.
It's something that you can make a connection with. And I guess my final question for you on this is then, are you also willing to re-examine your own responses to some of these issues?
What do you mean?
In other words, are you building trust, you know, simply in order to change someone else?
Mm-hmm.
Are you also willing to change in the event that the person with whom you've now formed a more authentic bond,
mm-hmm.
You're asking them to change their views. Are you willing to change your own?
I'd like to say yes. I think in the conversations with like folks that are more conservative Christian, I'm not going to change my views on a whole number of things, but on some of the things about like the liberal worldview and what you have to agree to in order to participate in a plural society, I'm like, oh, okay, maybe we don't all have to agree to some of these like end things. There is some things that I want us to agree on is like how we treat each other and how our policies should, you know, have equitable like frameworks that I'm definitely going to keep concerned about and keep that as my goal. But I can see like, okay, yeah, actually like I'm sort of making assumptions about who you are and all the things that you believe, because there's plenty of folks that are conservative on one thing, but then quote unquote liberal on another thing in the same, you know, so it interrupts my presumptions about who quote unquote they are.
And it illuminates a little bit about who you are, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. That you have kind of a co-created experience in which you might both transcend the conflict instead of simply cobbling together an unhappy compromise.
Yeah, because here's the thing that I came to in the last semester of seminary, or maybe a little bit before, but that one of the things that I have experienced in the progressive side of our politics and in our theology is this unstated thing that we have arrived at liberation. We have arrived at the better world and you all just need to get on board.
Like, yeah, yeah.
We know how to do it. You're like, no. None of us have lived in the better world. We're making it better. Like we're catching glimpses of it as we learn to hear each other and create spaces where we can be whole and safe and flourish. But none of us have arrived. None of us know. Like, there are plenty of, I know there are things that I'm going to have to give up in order for us to, like, respond to this really troubling UN report that came out on Monday. It's like, I you know, there are things we're going to all have to change. None of us have arrived at the better world. Maybe the Dalai Lama, I should say. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe the Nathan. Like, there's a few spiritual leaders that, but even they would be humble enough to say, I think, no, like this human life, you know. Wrong.
So what gives you, here's really my last question. What gives you hope? Because there's a lot of hopelessness in certainly in the American political scene right now, and in which is based, I believe, in large part on the American cultural scene right now. What gives you hope that we're going to be moving in the direction of creating a better world for all of us and not simply for the people who we agree with?
I think what gives me hope is what we were talking about at the very beginning, of people being inspired when they see other people stand up with each other. And they see other people meet each other's wounds. Like that is a ripple out effect. So that, you know, when I like helped walk alongside a group of women, I had been inspired by other people doing the same thing who were speaking out about sexual harassment and assault and misogyny in the church. I had been inspired by other people. And now I know that other people were inspired by what we did. Even though in the midst of it, we were like, it was incredibly incomplete and felt well, it just felt terrible because we didn't get all we wanted to get. We didn't get to the promised land.
Okay. And you're talking about a sexual harassment problem within the church that you facilitated women who had been sexually harassed, facilitated them being acknowledged by the church and also perhaps removing someone from the position that he was in, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's that specific case. But then also, if we just look at movements and social movements, we all are getting inspired and working with each other. I mean, you can look at letters between Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King and Gandhi. Like, you can look at letters between, you know, between leaders of these different movements who are inspiring and supporting each other. And so I get hope in that. I also get hope in the fact that that better angel really is there. And that transformation.
There are better angels
within all of us.
And that there's a higher power that inhabits us and that we inhabit. That's maybe 51% better angel, 49% Satan.
Yeah, you know, we might disagree on the percentages depending on the person and it's in the moment. But yeah, that I have seen transformation. People have told me about transformation, so I know that it's possible. And that's the thing that sort of sometimes gets lost when people ask me about my work. They say, must be really hard to like work with folks on like conflict. Must be really hard to talk, to read story after story about hate crime after hate crime. I'm like, yeah, it is. It's really heartbreaking. It's really hard. But because I do this work, I also get to work and see people and know people that are showing up like Helen did, that are showing up every day to try and make something better, that are pushing it forward, that see that better future that we can do. And so, yeah, it's hard work, but I also get to see the hope. I get to see the joy in that moment.
Well, I can say that you inspire me. Mm. And when I feel hopeless, I'll just pick up the phone and text you. I miss you. Cassandra is my niece. She is she is the better angel of my nature.
No.
And yes, you are. and I do see you as an arrow of hope into the future, and it's a privilege to know you.
Thank you. Thank you. I love you. And
I love you.
And I have been inspired by your transformations in your life. And
it's a virtuous circle.
It is.
Okay.
You're one of the helps of my life.
Well, thanks for coming on the show and talking about the work that you're doing. It's always great to see you, and I hope to see you in the flesh someday soon.
Yes, thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Pause, pause, pause. Joe, I know we went over.
That's it for this episode of She Negotiates. If you liked it, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and please leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, remember, the world needs what you have to offer. All you have to do is ask.